What's going on, blenders? It's Sean back to introduce you to another bonus episode of Real Blend, this time with director Tom George, who has a movie coming to theaters called See How They Run. We wanted to get Tom on the show because you're going to see that between now and the end of the year, we're going to see an influx of whodunits, and they're approaching it from different sides. Tom George's film, which has Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan, is more of a period piece, and it's structured around a murder taking place at the Agatha Christie staging of the show The Mousetrap, which is a little bit what See How They Run is based on. So it's a little bit of like a murder mystery inside of a murder mystery and a clever way to approach it. Later on, we'll talk about Rian Johnson's Glass Onion, a Knives Out movie, when that film comes closer in December, which is a totally different way into the whodunit structure. And I think both of them are really interesting for different reasons. So we wanted to make sure that we got Tom George on. We're bringing it to you as a bonus episode. We can also confirm 100% that we will be back with a full episode this Friday. We're going to be recording it shortly after I record this intro for Tom George. But we couldn't wait any longer to get this one out here because See How They Run is in theaters for people to go see. Make sure that you check it out. So without further ado, this is the Real Blend interview with Tom George on behalf of the new murder mystery comedy, See How They Run. We are a filmmaker-driven podcast, and so we like to get into the nitty-gritty about your process, essentially, and how films come together, and our audience has expectations of hearing some really nerdy stories, so feel free to geek out as much as possible.
I'm excited. Great.
Good.
Boys,
good.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you.
So the actual theater show, The Mousetrap, is actually integral to your storyline. And so I just wanted you to talk a bit about what your relationship is with the show. Had you been able to get a chance to go over and see it and how it might have affected you had you sat through it?
Guys, never seen it. Never seen the play. The truth is, I was due to go and watch it. And then there was a global pandemic. I don't know if you heard about that where you are. Yeah, that made it not possible. And at the time, I was quite, disappointed. Actually, I think it came to stand me in quite good stead because it was clear that it was important, I think, to distance ourselves enough from The Mousetrap in as much as, like, you don't need to have seen The Mousetrap to enjoy See How They Run. You know, anything that is taken from that play and referenced at all should be the sort of the goodies on the top of the cake rather than anything else, more integral than that. And in fact, it draws, Mark's script was so clever because it drew not just from The Mousetrap, but all sorts of different areas of the Christie kind of back catalogue, I suppose, in all sorts of different ways. But we agreed from the start that that should be the text, the sort of extra texture on top of what had to be a great story and some great characters that worked in their own right, irrespective of that sort of meta layer.
So just as a quick follow-up, in doing research for it, I realized that there in 1959, they were trying to mount a film adaptation of the movie with Tyrone Power. And I was curious if you knew about that at all and if it affected your approach.
The truth, the sort of true fact where the whole project started was that the kernel of truth at the center of our film and in real life is that The Mousetrap was a big hit on the West End, the biggest show of its time. And people wanted to make a film adaptation of it. And Christie signed a contract to say, you can adapt The Mousetrap with a caveat that you could only begin production once the original theatrical run had come to an end.
Oh, okay.
And of course, the joke, as we now know, it's never come to an end. She thought that it would last 8 months, maybe 10, was the sort of, that. And that at the time was huge. Like, I think that already would have outstripped the record run, or maybe the record run at the time was a year or somewhere around that mark.
Okay.
But it blew it out of the water, like how long it went on to run. And so on the one hand, it was like impossible to make a film of the Mousetrap, but it also felt like, I think when Damien, the producer, first hit upon that little nugget, like that could be the start of something, and this idea of a murder taking place at the world's most famous murder mystery.
Tom, I want to talk about when directing a murder mystery, how you make sure you don't sort of tip your hand with your own directorial style, like put any subconscious hints about the resolution that might give it away. Did you ever have to kind of scale yourself back or pull yourself back as a director to make sure that you weren't doing anything that was accidentally giving it away?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of things already, you know, built into the script that, you know, tease certain elements that might come to pass, you know, further down the line in the film. It's definitely, you know, a key part of it is we knew from the start we wanted it to function as a satisfying thriller, a satisfying murder mystery in its own right, but also as a comedy, you know, and tuning those two things was a big part of the process. You know, too much comedy and it starts to undermine the stakes of your thriller. But at the same time, you know, you play the dramatic elements too hard and the comedy drifts away. But certainly alongside that, you know, it was a learning curve for me in terms of just how you want to deliver that information and the right amount of information. You know, you don't want the audience to get ahead of the mystery and crack the thing too early. We've all, you know, seen films where that happens and you totally check out, right? So, but at the same time, by the time they get to that finale, you don't want to feel like it's come out of nowhere. So that was a process throughout. Writing, shooting, certainly, but particularly in the edit, as you can imagine.
A quick follow-up. How much do you think about what it's going to be like the second time someone watches this movie? Do you think about, like, you know, once we know all the secrets and we go back to the top, do you put things in for the people watching it the second time around?
For me, I always hope that in my work there's enough layers and enough detail, you know, that that it will, like, it make for a satisfying watch on a second time around. Mm-hmm. And that applies to everything. Certainly, like, Mark's script from, you know, the first time I read it, it was clear that it was so detailed that there would be stuff that you might get, you might not, you know, and that on subsequent viewings, you know, there might be more and more for you to find as you go along. But also comically, you know, I like to work in a way that there's a lot of two shots in the film. There's a lot of ensemble framing, you know. I'm not really one for, you know, cutting for a single for the line and cutting for the reaction, cutting for the, you know, next line, cutting for the reaction, you know, because for me, it's always been a more rewarding watch as an audience member when you aren't led by the nose quite to that extent through comedy. We've got these two brilliant characters played by Sam and Saoirse side by side, and it just instinctively felt right to present them, you know, in a two shot on you know, almost throughout the movie. And what that means is you've got the funny line and you've got the reaction. And then maybe there's something else that you hadn't noticed first time around, a funny thing that Sam's doing in the background while while the key bit of action that you're focusing on the first watch is going on. Yeah, that's a long way of saying, I hope it stands up to a second viewing. And that's always, like, I always find that, like, when a filmmaker's put in that much care and attention to detail into the thing, the audience can pick up on it almost by osmosis, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you can't identify the specific things on a first or even a second watch, you know, it comes through. You pick up that this is like a fully layered, textured world with loads of interesting things percolating in it.
Yeah. And those two shots are really effective in the car as well. Like when you have like a bit going back and forth between Saoirse and Sam, like even like there's that moment in the trailer about, like, you know, jumping to conclusions, like that works really funny. It's a funny moment because it's in the same shot. There's no safety of the cut. There's no, like, it's like even the awkwardness or the tension of that is great. And I want to ask you about the 1:85 aspect ratio, because I think that's a really interesting choice as a filmmaker, because you obviously could go widescreen, standard widescreen, 2:39, 2:35. But 1:85 gives you a really tall ratio. It gives you a lot of space up and down. And I just wonder, like, how that space factors into the mystery of it. How much you want us focusing on the full frame, looking up and down, and how tall things are, and the narrative decision to shoot in 1:85.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was driven less by the mystery element, and more by the core, the heart of the story, which is you've got these two police detectives entering this world where they are completely out of their depth in different ways, but they do not fit in. And so it's clear that we'd, you know, from a sort of costume point of view, that we'd have these two quite monochromatic police detective figures, Saoirse in her police uniform, Sam in his detective, you know, sort of his classic kind of detective outfit. And it just felt like a natural bit of storytelling to be able to present these two monochromatic characters entering this rich and vibrant world of West End theatre land. And the great thing about the taller frame of 185 is you really get to place the characters within their environment,
yeah.
Particularly in a largely interior environment. You know, we don't have many sweeping landscapes in this movie. It's sort of Soho, central London, built up urban environment and lots of interiors, obviously. And so it's a great way to be able to like see those characters in that environment and make those different locations really speak to the characters who they belong to as well. I think I particularly think that in like Mervyn's apartment, for example, when we go to his apartment, and his whole flat speaks to his character. You know, this guy who's brought back curiosities from all over the world. He's a bit of a hoarder. He's got, you know, he wears his intellect very much like in the things that he puts around him. So it was really rooted by that central thing of these two fish out of water characters, I think.
When do you make that decision? Because like obviously you go into production, you have rehearsals, you know, I mean, when is the decision made with your DP when you go, all right, we're going to do 185? Because it's a big choice. I mean, you could always shoot at 185 and then still crop it to 239 if you really wanted to, if you were able to like shoot it correctly, you know, if you wanted to play with that. But I mean, it's gotta be an interesting decision to make.
Yeah, definitely. It was in the pre-production that Jamie and I made that decision. And it certainly wasn't like nailed on from the start. We did shot some tests. But also more than that, as I was continuing to storyboard certain sequences and Jamie was increasingly involved in that process, and he understood how I wanted to use the visual layer of the storytelling to reinforce, you know, the script, it kind of more and more became the obvious choice, I suppose. So that by the end, it was like, I think we'd started off debating more actively, like, you know, would we do, you know, 235, 185, what route would we go? And then I think we both came to the, you know, the point where we just turned to each other at a certain point and said, it's going to be 185, right? That's what we're doing. You know, it's
awesome.
It kind of got
that. I love that ratio. It actually works great at home too, because you know, you get more of the screen, you get more of the image on your screen at home.
Yeah.
They can't move the screens at home like you do in a theater. So
I knew that I wanted to like frame people in groups as much as possible. And the two shot and the mid shot would be king. There's barely any close-ups of characters. Objects get sort of close-ups more than people. But it was interesting going back to what you were saying about the two shots in the car. The other side to it is that it opens up the possibility for improv or little alternate takes on lines, or for you just to continue to work the material on the floor, which is always part of the way I like to work. And you know, part of the challenge was how do we have that freedom to be able to work in that way? And if you're in a high coverage situation where you've got three sizes of a single on someone, and then you're turning around and come around for the other person's three sizes, you get halfway through that and you want to change a line. It's like, well, what are we going to do? Go back and shoot, you know, turn back around and shoot that. The nice thing about, you know, putting people in a two shot is, and particularly letting that exchange run for half a scene, means that you can continue to work the material. You know, you're going to have the other side of that, their reaction to that line or their response to that line, because you've got both of them on camera. So it was definitely a part of it, you know, for me, is trying to have at least that possibility of improv or things rising to the surface, like available to us. And actually outside the Savoy in the car is one of my favorite moments that did arise in that way. When Sam asks Saoirse, do you write everything down in your notebook? And she says, well, only if it's important, sir. And he says, well, how do you know if it's important? That was actually a cold out. As scripted, that was like a hard out. Like, just he left her with that kind of cliffhanger ending to a scene, and we cut away somewhere else. And through like rehearsal, I think Sam and Saoirse and I had talked about, well, maybe, you know, I'm always interested in if you like play things long at the end of a scene, whether it leads you anywhere. And nine times out of 10, it doesn't. But once in a while, it throws up something interesting. So we said, look, what if you just follow that thread? Like, what does she say?
Yeah.
And so Saoirse came up with this thing where she's like, well, you know, I write everything down. And then when we find out later what's important, we'll know that it's already in the notebook. So it's really like satisfying that there are moments like that that we managed to like find along the way with the cast.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Well, and Tom, I feel like whenever people give Saoirse a chance to be funny, it reminds us of like, you know, whether it's Lady Bird or Grand Budapest or something like that. And you're like, oh, that's right. She's extremely funny. And she's terrific in this movie. And, you know, is almost she's being set up by Sam, you know, in so many of the scenes. And so I want you to be able to talk about letting her be funny, because also the thing that the movie does that I really love the most is that it openly pokes fun at the whodunit tropes, but then almost admits that like we also can't tell an interesting story without using some of them, and a lot of them fall back on her kind of thing. So can you just talk about the approach of embracing them and letting her sort of go to town on them?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'll say is that it was not scripted to be an Irish character. Like it was scripted as a London accent. And when, you know, Saoirse was the first person that I thought of for that part, sent her the script. And on the first chat that we had remotely over Zoom, one of the first things we discussed was she said, well, how do you feel about me doing it in my own accent? And I'm always, you know, one for kind of giving as little acting for the actor to do as possible, right? Don't give them extra things to worry about if you don't need to do that. You know, don't give the classics like fake TV watching, right? Like if you've ever, you know, you if you have people watching TV and they're not watching something on a screen, you never sell it, right? Because there's that granular specific thing about what the eyes do or what your body language does and where your attention, where your gaze is drawn, that you pick up on like without realizing it.
Is that like typing on a laptop also? No, yeah, one taps on a laptop convincingly.
There's definitely times where the sound team step in and say, look, you can't see that laptop. Can you please not have her tapping all the way through? but yeah, it's sort of, you know, so it was really exciting to me to think of her doing it in her accent. Again, particularly in terms of things like looseness, improvisation, and it fitted so well with the character to have this you know, young Irish woman who come to London in the 1950s. It felt like it enriched the character almost kind of instantly. So that was great. And we so rarely get to see Saoirse doing her own accent. Like you, I had no like worries that she was going to be really funny in this film, because, you know, but I think for her, it was still a step into the unknown. In terms of it being a kind of out and out comedy in some ways. I think that's how she would think of it, you know. Lady Bird is like more in the comedy drama sort of world, I suppose. True. But, you know, I always felt like I loved her in that film. And as soon as we talked about it, it was key that she just got the tone, you know, and that for the director when you're bringing a cast together is probably the single biggest, you know, thing is like, do the cast get what it is that you're trying to, you know, achieve with this, where you're trying to pitch things tonally? And this was a complex piece tonally, because on the one hand, you've got, you know, this murder mystery. It's got to work as a murder mystery, as I've said. But it's a period piece, but it's got a very modern kind of thread running through it. And I kind of always felt like performances would be the key to that. If it had this kind of rooted, understated, contemporary comic feel to the performances, that would like create a really fun tension between this, what your expectations of the stuffy drawing room murder mystery, with everyone being a little bit arch and a little bit over the top, you know.
This is a terrific element when the one actress walks in and she goes, "You got me, I did it." And Saoirse immediately turns around and starts reading her rights. And Sam Rockwell's gonna be like, relax, she's just, it's a turn of phrase.
And as you said, like the other side of it obviously is Sam. It's like really, I think of the film as like a story of a partnership, right? Really that's what's going on beneath it. It's like, there's a murder mystery, but really it's the story of this like dysfunctional partnership and whether they're gonna be able to get on the same page, come together to crack the case.
Right.
And you know, watching Sam and Saoirse come together to like, you know, play those roles was just a total joy every day. And Sam, as you rightly say, is often the straight man, you know, particularly in the first, you know, kind of act of the film, he's the straight man and Saoirse gets a lot of the, you know, the kind of funny lines. And I think in other hands, that Stoppard character could, become a little neutral or mute or not very interesting. And the brilliant thing about Sam is that he makes choices that other people wouldn't, and he just opens up the character with like nuance and detail and kind of makes you want to know what's going on under the surface, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually perfectly leads into my next question, because I do want to talk about Sam, because I feel like even though obviously he has an Oscar, but I still feel like Sam Rockwell is just a genuinely underappreciated actor. And I'm curious about what is it about him that works so well for so many different... I'm sorry, what was that?
Yeah, he's a real up-and-comer. Yeah, he's...
I know, right? Like one of these days, he's just really going to take off. But I feel like he's the kind of actor that like I have to grab like common moviegoers and be like, you love this guy, whether or not you truly realize it. So I was just wondering, like, what are some of his performances maybe you wish more average moviegoers appreciated more? Because like personally, I think he should have gotten an Oscar nomination or even one for Moon. I thought Moon was phenomenal. Not enough people talk about that.
Or Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moon is like particularly astonishing.
The ping pong scene. I mean,
moment. He like single-handedly literally carries the whole film. Right? And I think that's, you know, that if you haven't seen Moon for some reason, definitely, you know, go and see that. And, you know, on the comedy side, you know, he's obviously worked a lot on Martin McDonagh's films. And those, you know, Seven Psychopaths and then more recently Three Billboards.
Matchstick Men with Ridley is terrific.
Oh yes,
that's a great film.
Yeah,
for me it felt like exciting to put him in the center of a comic world, you know. I think from certainly recent memory, he's often in the ensemble playing a like really funny part who steals scenes. Mm-hmm. Right. Sure. Jojo Rabbit is another one, right? Comes in, steals scenes, that, you know, and that's incredible in its own right. But I think it was really exciting to see him like right at the heart of this comic story. And as I say, to be doing something, I think slightly out of his usual zone in terms of like, he's playing the more rooted character, the guy who's kind of kept bringing gravitas as well, which was a big part of like what attracted us to Sam as well. It's like so much of the comedy plays, particularly in the early part of the film, on like Saoirse's character making mistakes in front of the boss, right? In front of this guy who like is really experienced and who she needs to respect and like feel like those gaffes like are gonna eat her up at night because she can't believe she said that in front of this, you know, important detective. And so that's the other side of it, is like Sam brings that in spades. And it was just like, once we thought of him for the character, it was kind of hard to think of anyone else. And that's even with the accent, you know, even knowing that, okay, look, we'd be talking about him doing a British accent, you know, which is, you know, as I've said regarding Saoirse, like look, ideally everyone would do their real voice, you know, mm-hmm. for me. But from the first time Sam and I talked, you know, the other thing that people might not know about him is he's an incredibly hard worker. Like he really works hard, and he will only take on roles if he feels like he can do it, you know? So from the first chat we had about it, you know, I felt really confident that he was gonna, you know, get that right. And I think he really did, you know, as a someone with a sort of middling London accent. He nailed the middling London accent. Yeah.
I want to geek out with you about Daniel Pemberton, because I remember interviewing I remember Steve Jobs came out, and I remember Danny Boyle talking a lot about the process of that movie, and kind of not even from the cinematography standpoint alone, where he shot 16, 35 and digital as the different years went on. But even Daniel recorded his score on different like machines that like then got better with digital age as we got later in the story. But he's just a phenomenal composer. And I just wanted to ask about like you working with him, like what his score meant to you the first time you hear it. And, you know, in terms of like a composer, a score can be a leading character. So I wonder, like, are there conversations that with Daniel almost like you have with an actor? Because that, you know, it plays a huge part in the world of it.
Yeah, and it plays a huge part in establishing place, you know, time, and also tone. And again, like that was crucial for us. Is like, how do we like support the comedy but not overplay the comedy? How do we like evoke the films of that period in some way musically? And it was I would, you know, not speaking for Daniel, but it was a tricky needle to thread for us, you know, to find out where that balance lay. And not just for Daniel, it was with all the HODs, I'd had the same discussion really, which was that you got this period film set in 1953 and you want to create a world that feels like fully realized, like a fully realized version of 50s London. But at the same time, this whole film only functions from a contemporary viewpoint.
You need
to know about the history of cinema and theater and mysteries, film noir, detective novels, you know, all of that is sort of in there. Not that you need to know it in detail, but you need to know the amount that you know subconsciously through, you know, living in the world. And with Daniel, when it came to the score, it was the same riddle that we had to kind of crack. It was, on the one hand, we wanted to evoke the music to a certain extent of the period, but then how do we unseat it enough or just put a twist on it to tell the audience, yeah, it's familiar, it feels like those things, but also there's something a little off kilter with this. It's not quite what I expected, you know? And so it was really, yeah, it was the same sort of approach in terms of what I talked about before with performance. It's like, okay, on the surface, you've got a drawing room based murder mystery set in the West End of London. Well, hopefully the performances just tell you, well, but wait, is this like, what is the like real viewpoint of this film? Is it made today? Is it made then, you know? And that should just be a little kink in it, I think. And I think Daniel's done an incredible job with the score by you know, you at times like letting it really breathe into a full scale, you know, score that really draws on the period, but at times just bringing odd bits of instrumentation to it that make you question that and just slightly sort of put a little wrinkle in it. Mm. My favorite thing that he did was I was like, yeah, this is great, but we just need something like a little more organic or homemade in it. That was quite often the thing, was like just finding something to like root it a little bit somehow. And he was like, oh, what, like sort of this? Ding, 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 ding. And he just had a water bottle there with a thing. And that ended up in the movie, basically. He thought, like, with this water bottle filled to different heights, you know, tuning that way. And
wait, really? For real? Like you filled water bottles to different heights and hit them?
Yeah, you know how it is. You got a half full, it'll have a different time. Yeah. Than if it's three quarters full. And that's one of, it's in that piece when Stalker is running through Soho searching for Stoppard.
Yeah.
And it's got this, if you listen, and it's got this little ding, 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 And it's like it's Daniel whacking on a water bottle. So that's about working with him. It's like, on the one hand, you see him working with an orchestra, and we were lucky enough to record the score at Abbey Road in London, which was like a total pinch yourself moment for me. And to watch Daniel working with that orchestra and fine-tuning things on the fly was like astonishing, you know, to see his you know, how talented he is. But at the same time, he can bring these like really unexpected characterful flourishes to the music. So, it was a real joy working with
him. Take that, John Williams.
Yeah, exactly. Whacking on a glass water bowl.
Tom, I'll get you out of here on this one because we're running out of time. But obviously a huge part about the Mousetrap when it played in theaters was Christy being concerned about the ending and maintaining spoilers and swearing to the people, you know, that hey, you're part of this mystery now and don't ruin it for somebody else. What are your thoughts about spoilers, and especially someone who's directed a murder mystery, and how do you worry about containing them in the internet age?
That's a great question. I generally think spoilers, my attitude overall, I mean, how long have we got here? My attitude overall is like, there should be a spoiler window, right? There are no spoilers for The Sixth Sense at this point in time. And okay. Like, if I tell you now, and I'm not going to do that because I'm respectful. If I tell you now, the ending to The Sixth Sense, you can't go, I was going to watch that. You've had 20 years here.
Yes.
But so there's a shelf life, I would say. But yeah, look, it's like when you know people, treat it like you would with your friends, right? It's like you if you know they're going to go and watch the movie, or they might watch the movie in the next few weeks, look, let them enjoy it as it's supposed to be enjoyed. You know, nobody wants those things ruined for them. What I'll say more specifically about the whodunit genre, I think, and the reveal is like, it's oddly although it seems it's in the name, right? The whodunit, it seems like the be all and end all of the genre. Everything's building to that moment. But I think that's a MacGuffin in a way. Like, they're like not, it's not the most important part of a whodunit.
Right.
Like, it's, I think the most fun part is when all the pieces are in the air, right? And you're trying to, you go and you meet each character and you're trying to work out what's their tick, what's their tell. Like, what can I learn about them here? Being on that journey with the detectives as they kind of try and crack the case, that's when it's at its best. So, you know, I think hopefully it's a really satisfying reveal in the movie, but also they're just a great place to put characters under pressure, aren't they? Like, your detectives are on a ticking clock. They've got to crack the case, right? The boss is onto them. All the other characters are usually suspects in the piece, so they're under pressure. And that's a great source of like, drama but also comedy, right? And so they're just really satisfying stories, I think, to for an audience.
Well, then I wish we had more time to talk about David Oyelowo and Adrian Brody and some other fantastic actors that you have in your piece. So we really appreciate your time and coming on the show, and we can't wait to send people to go check out, see how they run.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thank you so much to Tom George for coming on the show. As for the real ones who are sticking around, as I mentioned, we're going to have a full show coming to you guys on Friday. And I can confirm as well, too, because it's in the can, that Baz Luhrmann is joining the show on behalf of Elvis, which is coming to home video from Warner Brothers. So another really exciting interview. You guys are going to have a ton of fun with Baz. In the show, he's a great fit for Real Blend, and you guys know that we're all big fans of Elvis. So keep it right here. We will have more Real Blend content coming your way. To make sure you don't miss anything that we put out here, hit subscribe and turn on your notifications. Join the Real Blend family, and we'll be back with some new content very, very soon.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.